This is Radio Free Brooklyn, and you're listening to Brooklyn Player. I'm your host, Veronica Newton. Every month, I interview Brooklyn-based musicians. Coming up, I'm speaking to Andrew D'Angelo, who plays alto saxophone and bass clarinet. Here's one of his compositions, Enzo. Thank you so much, Andrew, for taking time to talk to me.
You're welcome.
I wanted to ask you about your album, Norman. That's a really beautiful album that came out.
Thank you.
What was the process of putting that together? So what was the original inspiration for it?
Well, the original inspiration was the fact that, I want to say, the timeline was about 3 years after I had had two brain surgeries. To remove what was a cancerous brain tumor. And I had just started going back on the road and playing music and composing music again. And yeah, everything on that record is, I'm just jogging my memory here. Everything on that, on Norman, is post-surgery, post-brain cancer, composed music. And in fact, the song Norman, which is written by my friend Bill McHenry, which is my middle name, Norman, which is my grandpa's first name, and he's the picture on the cover of that album, it's all healing music in some form or another. And I recorded that with Jim Black and Trevor Dunn in Manhattan, and that was 2009, 2010. And then I shelved it because for some reason I didn't feel like it was releasable at that time, you know, for whatever reason. I didn't feel, was I ready? You know, the doctors were like, I don't know, you're probably not going to live much longer anyway. You know, there was all kinds of things that were going around in my own head. So for me, and then about 2 years ago, I had got this new manager, and he asked me if I had any buried, you know, records or music. And so I sent that to him. He's like, gah, man, you have to release this music. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And I hadn't listened to it in a long time. And I was like, you know what? Actually, he's right. Sometimes as an artist, as a performer, it's difficult to have perspective on your own work. I know that I'm writing a book, and I've been talking to authors, and it's the editor is key because they have this perspective that you don't have on your own writing. So anyway, the decision was made. Like I said, I think it was about 2 years ago, year and a half, whatever, from this 2015 now, is it like 2014, to release it. And my manager said, you know, you really should put it on vinyl because this music deserves to put on vinyl. So I had it remixed with a recording engineer, Jamie Saft, and then I had it mastered for vinyl. And then, you know, began the process of preparing music to be put onto vinyl, which, to be honest, in spite of my age, you know, at 50 years old, I had never put out an LP, as we were jokingly calling it, vinyl, as the kids call it today.
Right.
So for me, it was not a process I had been through. And, you know, we're talking about the thickness of the vinyl, the location of the songs on the vinyl make a difference. Because the grooves change from the outside of the record, or the vinyl, to the inside of the record.
So you had to make those decisions?
I didn't really know much about that. My manager made all those decisions. So right. What we call the sequencing, what songs, tunes you hear first, and which ones you hear at which cycle closer to the inside. He made all those decisions, and I just went with it because, you know, he said, the grooves are tighter here, and they're thicker here, and they're farther apart here, and this song will work here. I'm like, yeah, I just kind of threw my hands in the air, like, man, all right. He knows a lot about it. And he also told me to go for the 180-gram vinyl, which is, as my memory, if memory serves me, is what originally all vinyl was. But nowadays, to say money or whatever, people, there's different thicknesses you can get. And sometimes, you know, certain, you know, indie rock bands or something might go with the really inexpensive, you know, thin vinyl. And it, you know, as far as sound quality, I guess it's not supposed to be as high quality as the thicker vinyl.
Track is Norman and is composed by Bill McHenry.
And also there's this process where you send the sequence and the master to the place that's going to press your vinyl, right? And then they tell you that everything's working okay, and then they do this test pressing, which was interesting. So they run off 5 copies of your vinyl for you and send it to you, and then you have to check them to see if there's any flaws in the pressing. And that was actually a fun process, listening to my record 5 times, you know, in full, which I actually did several times. And you're supposed to go to different turntables and do that again.
Right.
And you shouldn't just
see how it's tracking.
That's right. You shouldn't just do it on one system, and to make sure that they're all playable. And then once that process is over, the test pressings are okay by, you know, the artist or whoever, the producer, whoever's doing it. I was both in this case. Then you move on with the pressing, which actually these days is very interesting because it takes 3 months, sometimes longer, because so many people are doing vinyl that they're backlogged. There's not enough pressing plants to make the vinyl that the demand.
Because the demand has spiked.
Exactly. So just pressing the vinyl took 3 months. Actually, I think it took even longer, like 3.5.
Really?
And during that process, I started working on the art, the cover art, which I did everything myself. The outside and everything is all hand work that I did myself, paintings and drawings. And
That's so beautiful.
Oil pastels, yeah. It was really fun, actually. And I have to give my brother credit for the cover photo of my grandfather, Norman, because it was his idea. And he goes, you should put this photo on there. And it's interesting because the record's now been out for several months. And just recently, in the last few weeks, that cover has been getting some stimulation, some attention. And people are like, who is that? That is such a great photo. And my cousins who live in Nebraska are just recently all bought it and are all excited about the cover because that's their grandfather, too. So anyway, it's been fun. For me, there's no doubt that one thing about doing a vinyl is the art. Because if there's anything that's maybe been lost in this whole digital age now, is that artwork, right?
Yes, that tactile feeling, yeah, of holding it in your hand, opening it
up. The physicality, right. Mm-hmm. And also, yeah, the gatefold. I did a gatefold. It's not a double album, but so it does open up. So it, as I think it was my manager said, he said, it's a lot of real estate, you know, to work with as far as art.
Right.
And I did a lot of stuff, like if I was going to a friend's house or something for a gathering or a rehearsal, I would check out their vinyl collection and look at their, you know, the covers just to see what kind of things people had done in the past, you know, just to get a feel for it. And then, you know, this process of recording or composing, recording, doing the artwork, getting the music sequenced, getting the pressing done, mixing and mastering, you know, this was several years of time.
Wow.
And I did this interview, I want to say in the summer. Yeah, it was the summer this year. And one of the questions the guy asked, actually it was the first question, as I remember, he said, why do you think jazz musicians are so late to the party? And I was like, what party? He said, the vinyl party. So I think it might have to do with the cost. I mean, when I sat down with my manager and ran numbers when we were trying to figure out the price point of what I was going to sell them for, I spent almost $12,000 from beginning to end to get this particular piece of vinyl called Norman and release it to the public.
That's pretty hefty. So that's after the recording.
I'm including the recording.
But that's still a very hefty.
He insisted that every cost be included to understand. And I think, actually, I should be selling them for $96 each to really match up with that price point, because we have very limited pressing, very custom vinyl. Not quite half of the records are white vinyl, which is so cool. I never thought it would be so cool, but I really like it.
Yeah.
And that does cost you, you know, a different amount of money than the black vinyl, so it's considered custom. But anyway, so as far as jazz being late to the party, it might be that, you know, they don't want to invest $12,000 in one recording. But, you know, I don't know. I don't have an answer to that question. I know for me, I have absolutely no regrets. And it was incredibly fun to generate such a piece of art. I say a beautiful piece of art, but it's my own. What else am I going to say?
Here is Improve by Human Feel off the album Galore, featuring Jim Black on drums, Andrew D'Angelo on sax, Chris Speed on tenor sax, and Kurt Rosenwinkel on guitar.
You wanted to talk about the band Human Feel, right?
I do, yeah, because I went and saw it was a recording session in the studio that was open to a small audience where Human Feel played in Williamsburg in the studio there, and it was one of the best concerts I've ever seen in my life. I really loved it.
Wow.
So I know that one's in the works. And then I think you have another Human Feel album in the works. Is that right?
Yeah, we did the one you're speaking about, which is at the end of the two-day recording session. We did a live performance with all the microphone set up, but just had a wonderful, beautiful audience, including you. And that was really, it was really interesting to compare the live audience recorded material to the other material we had done over the course of the other 2 days. I won't compare that now, but that music was being worked on and worked on and worked on, and then something happened that froze the project.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're shaking your head. You know,
well,
that story.
It happens sometimes.
Right. Like,
sometimes things just stall
it just,
out
it
and freeze.
It stalled out. That's a great word. And
yeah.
Basically, actually, that recording, which for me is the pinnacle, is the pinnacle human feel recording. And I can't speak for Crispy, Jim Black, or Kurt Rosenwinkel, the other guys in the band. But for me, it absolutely. And so to have lost that recording temporarily was very, very upsetting.
Mm-hmm.
And then about a month ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, I met somebody who said, actually, I know how to recover that recording. It was basically what it was the hard drive that all the music on was had been.
Oh.
I'm going to use the word fragmented, but I'm not I don't know the technical.
Down.
It was just destroyed, basically.
No.
In Human Feel's mind, it was like gone.
Right.
I met somebody, a recording engineer, said, no. I'll come pick it up. And he goes, I know how to open up the hard drive. And I don't know what he did, but over the course of a week,
magic.
He did some magical thing and reconstructed the whole session. And all of a sudden, we got this music back.
This is incredible.
Right.
That's so great.
Well, in the meantime, since we, Human Feel, thought we had lost that recording, that it was not ever going to be released because we didn't have any of the files, we didn't have any, you know, it was gone.
Yeah.
But which isn't the case. Now, we went back in the studio at the end of last month. Oh, it was September, end of September, out in Jersey. And we went to the studio called Water Music. I say that because I love the studio. I love the guy who runs it. It was such a great experience. And you can record all day, and then you have dinner there, and you spend the night. And then you get up, and you can record all day again. That was pretty amazing, actually, to have that amount of time to create.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a lot of improvised stuff. We all had new compositions. We had plenty of time to get the music the way we wanted it or right, I guess.
It gives you some breathing room. It gives you some space. You're not rushing in, rushing out.
That's right.
On this crazy timetable.
I mean, you hear those stories, you know, of like the Rolling Stones or whoever, you know, spending 6 months in the studio or 3 months in the studio. So basically, okay, go create. And usually they would just drink and party the whole time until the last few days. I mean, so I never was at one of those sessions, but here.
Right, the procrastinating.
Yeah, they would just get stoned or whatever. And then, oh man, we got to make a record. Shit.
Right.
But in the case of Human Feel, we're a little more, I don't know what the word is. Well, we were very disciplined.
Yes.
We used our time wisely. But 2 days, as long as you want, limitless two recording days, you know, was... the first time I had experienced that anyway, and it was, So now we have two Human Feel records that are in the can, as they say. But I wanted to transition because the interesting thing is that I was so jacked and, excited about my vinyl, the Norman vinyl, that I was asking Human Feel. I said, we should really do a vinyl with this and, you know, record analog. There was so much resistance from the band. I was so surprised.
Mm.
At least one of the guys was like, yeah, that would be cool. But at least one of the other guys was like, what's the point? Let's just put it on a USB stick and, you know, sell those.
Right, right.
So not everybody's on the vinyl fence.
But when you have the whole array of the collective chiming in, you know, everyone has a different thought process of how it should be.
Yeah, and I mean... Yeah, collectives, and plus, you know, Jim Black and Chris Speed and I have known each other since we were 14, 15 years old. So it's a collective band, and then add in, like, 30 years of, friendship, man. The shit can get weird. I mean, it's always all love, man. It's always love, but, you know, the shit can get weird.
Yeah.
But we made it, and I still think we should do a vinyl, but anyway, it's not too
late. Yeah, so you planted that seed, you know, maybe.
I'm going to work on manifesting that, Veronica. I'm going to keep working on it. But
well, I can just imagine the quality. It would be pretty incredible if that ever happens someday. So stars will align. Well, the other thing I wanted to ask you about was DNA Orchestra. So you have a big band project that you write and compose for and put together an amazing big band. What's happening with DNA Orchestra?
Well, we did that recording. What do you think, Veronica? Was it 2012, 2013? Something like that.
Yeah.
And that record, I mixed five different times with five different recording engineers
to get the entire thing, or big chunks of it.
For the most part, the entire thing. Some of the songs we got earlier on, in other words, the mixes were fine and they were sounding good. The issue we had with the big band, which is 13 people, actually 14 because I had a violist on the recording, was that, you know, everybody's sitting next to each other, so their microphones, there was what we call bleeding, you know, where sound, like this tenor sax is getting to the alto sax and so on and so forth. The trombones are behind the saxophones, so the trombones are getting... So when you're mixing the faders and everything, you know, things are just... It's a difficult mix, let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah. And sounds really challenging to record it at all.
Exactly. And but to be honest, I did not participate in the recording aspect. I just let the engineer do whatever he wanted, and I just focused on my music and getting everybody in a place mentally and emotionally or whatever, and energetically, to play the music and perform it the best that we could. And then I worried about the... Actually, I never even worried about it. I dealt with the mixing and the little nuances that are... Or what could be called complications of mixing a big band where there's bleeding, you know, leakage is another word they use.
Right. It's kind of like a live... Like what you might encounter when you're recording something live with that many people. Or,
yeah, actually, it is. Right, you mean like live on stage or something
yes,
like that?
Yes,
yeah, or exactly. Like when you watch a YouTube video of a band and it's a live concert and it's exactly.
It's not a pristine studio experience.
It's not a pristine, like, studio experience. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's not
with each instrument on a different track.
Exactly.
And optimized. And,
right, which isn't better or worse. It's just we were mixing on different, in each instrument on a different track, but there's all this leakage and so on. It was definitely a task. So after five engineers and five times, you know, mixing it, we finally got a final product. So now the issue is, again, same with the Human Feel and the same with my trio record, and is what is the presentation going to be? How are we going to release this? Now, I would say for about the last year, I've taken a break from the big band, just as far as the dynamic of the cost of traveling with a large ensemble and even just putting a show together in here in Brooklyn. You know, it's thousands of dollar investment, thousands of dollars of investment to get that band together and make sure everybody's taken care of as far as being paid and so on and so forth. So I took a break. I mean, we did like, it was a show at Shapeshifter Lab. I don't, you know, that place.
Yes.
Here in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And I was emailing about rehearsals, just getting ready for the show. And I happened to glance up at the number of emails that I had sent, you know, regarding this rehearsal. And it was hundreds. My memory says 263 or something like that. Just to set up rehearsals. That's not even the show.
Right. Logistically.
And I was like, whoa, the logistics of a big band is intense. And I just took a break. And I did a lot of traveling the last year, especially. Like, I'm pretty sure it was gone half the year, if not more. And I didn't want to manage. But once the recording is released, then it will become active again. And I just recently got asked by a promoter. He said he wanted the big band to have a residency in Brooklyn.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and he said he would fund it, and he said, what kind of money would you want? And I expressed my desires for what I wanted my band to be paid, and he said, absolutely. So now we're just looking for a venue that is, you know, is ready to have a big band on a regular basis. So that'll be cool. I'm very much looking forward to that. My feeling, here's what I'm manifesting in my own meditations and my own, you know, vision of it, is that the release of the recording and the residency for the big band will all culminate and happen all at the same time.
That would be really beautiful. Anything else that is going on that's coming up? This should air in December, at the end of December is what I'm figuring. So things coming up for 2016?
Yeah, I have a bunch of stuff going on for next year. One of which is related to Reed Anderson, who's a great bass player, works with the Bad Plus. A lot of people probably know about that band, who has started his own project with Bill McHenry, the tenor player, and myself. And Reed Anderson is doing compositions, and he is using electronics to perform these compositions. And Bill McHenry and myself are playing, obviously, our saxophones. So we're doing some shows with Reed in the coming year. That's a very cool project for those who haven't heard it. We haven't really played around Brooklyn, in New York much yet. We've done a few of my salons here at my own place and a couple public performances. But other than that, Reed has just been working on his concepts for it. But we did do a recording, and that is being mixed as you and I sit here and chat. Nice. And it should be out. The concepts, it'll be out for our first performance of the year, which is, I want to put a date. It's Winter Jazz, but I think it's January 15th. I'd have to look at my calendar.
Right, around that time.
January 15th or 16th, something like that.
Great.
So that's yet another recording that I did, which I'm not the leader on it, but, Reed Anderson, Bill McHenry, Andrew D'Angelo is a very special dynamic. Reed was just here for a salon. I think you were at that one as well,
yes.
Right? 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Which actually was my birthday salon, right? And he played some of that music. So did you hear any of it?
I didn't. I had to leave a little early, but right. I heard it at a different salon.
Okay.
With you, Bill.
We did it live that night, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, which was fantastic.
Yeah, I think
loved it because I'm really into electronic music.
Yeah, me too. And although I have dabbled, I've never taken it very serious. I haven't gotten very serious about it. I have a few recordings with electronics, but what Reed is doing is full on composition, almost predetermined electronic music, which is very, 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 very nice as far as I'm concerned.
It is. And to hear you guys play it live was just a wonderful experience.
Well, yeah, if you were at one of those salons, then we were just working it out, which is really what my salons are for, is for artists to share their work. And it doesn't have to be necessarily completed or finished or polished or ready for the studio or anything. It can be. But
yeah.
My salons are really about exploration. Both in music, but also just in people's spiritual journeys, and in their energetic journeys, in their conceptual, ideas, and anyway.
Well, that's really important as a part of the process, because things have to get from A to B somehow, and you have to have that process of having a safe place to play around with it and put it out there, and you still have an audience.
You were just talking to me before we started the interview about a venue in the Lower East Side in Manhattan.
Yes.
Which, as you said, where comedians and such would go to work out their material, right?
Yes, yes. It was called Surf Reality. And
right.
It's one of the founders of Radio Free Brooklyn founded Surf Reality.
Right, that was
and
the
And that's
connection.
What it was for. That's what it existed for, was a safe place where people could try stuff out and
right, well,
have
that,
a nice audience.
Yeah, exactly. And that is exactly what's going on here when I have my salons. And, I did a salon here with this classical composer who really didn't want to work out the material. you know, it's more about, in the classical world, as far as my experience goes, it's a finished product. You don't improvise your way to it. It's like the composer does the work, the performers rehearse it, and then you hear the performance, right?
Right.
Is that your experience?
Yes, yes. And so, that's pretty much, they don't want to show any rough or raw
right.
thing so in between them. It's a rehearsal then.
Right, exactly.
If it's rough or raw, I'm being worked out.
Right. So anyway, she agreed to do the salon and did not invite one person. It was basically a performance for me, and I think there was a couple other people here. But no, it was okay, because she did it, and the music I thought was absolutely beautiful, but it was there was I could also feel the resistance of, I don't really want to work out my music in front of an audience, you know?
Yes.
Or in front of other people. I mean, for me, like with Reed Anderson, when we did those salons, I think we did three of them. For him, it's all about that. And in fact, at one of the salons, we started asking the audience to give us feedback, because it was all very well-known and established musicians who were in the room here. And they were giving us their honest feedback about, you know, the music and the presentation. And that was really, really great. And so before the interview, when you told me that about the comedians coming to work out the material, I was like, great. So what, when we see, you know, like Seinfeld do the Seinfeld show, I mean, he even talks about now in that new show he has on the internet about how they would work out their material at that place in LA. I'm not remembering the name of the place right now, but.
The Comedy Store.
Yeah, exactly. Like they would literally stand backstage and wait for their turn so they can go out for 10 minutes or whatever, 20 minutes, and work on their material. And now all of a sudden we see them, you know, on TV with their own TV shows or whatever it is. And we think, well, they just went from, like you said, point A to point B and that's it. But actually there is something in between there, that process, which, you know, this day and age, in New York, there's not a lot of places to do that right now. I mean,
not right now.
Right.
No, there used to be quite a bit more that were these amazing resources, and that's why they existed.
Yeah, that almost was their sole purpose, right?
Yeah.
And so for me, I had a loft myself and was doing the same thing 15 years ago, you know, down in Gowanus here in Brooklyn. And then for whatever reason, I had to give up that loft. I think it went, a business took it over or something. But anyway, it was fine. I was done, and I was hosting my salons there. I called them Andy's Playhouse, but anyway, same difference. And I meet people literally to this very day who come to either my salons or whatever, or I meet on at a gig. They're like, "Oh, we met at one of your events, you know, 15 years ago, and we've been working together since." I mean, there's that aspect of it too, which is just community. You know, the chance for, you know, one person, one artist, comedian, whatever they are, actor, to meet another person that all of a sudden they garner this relationship and start creating together. And it's because they're not in the context of stage, stay away from me, audience, you know, separation kind of situation.
It's much more fluid.
Yeah, it's very fluid. Good word. I like that word. I'm going to start using that word for it. I like using the word entanglement, because that's what they use in science. So they figured out scientifically that, or they discovered, they say, that when you entangle two cells and then separate them, either in two different environments, two different rooms, doesn't matter. If you affect one with some kind of energy, the other one also reacts.
Interesting.
So they are forever connected, okay? So one entanglement, that's the scientific term, entanglement, allows those cells to forever be connected. So when I open my home and have these salons, it really is about individuals just, becoming entangled. And who knows, they may work together one day. They might write a book together one day, write a play together, or, you know, who knows?
Yeah, definitely.
Artists and non-artists alike. I mean, I think everybody has artistic abilities, but, you know, that's just in their own way.
Exactly.
I was doing some research during my own meditation retreat and cleansing that I was doing a few weeks ago. And the woman I was studying, her name is Dolores Cannon, who's since passed away, but she calls it your passion. Instead of saying your craft or your artistic, you know, ability, it doesn't matter. Every human soul has a passion, and that's really the goal, is to find your passion. And once you find your passion, then it's just a process of creating via that passion for the rest of your life. And you are creating, whether that's managing a business, you know, that sells corrugated cardboard boxes, or whether that's painting, you know, it doesn't matter, or making music. Yeah. I like that. It's passion. That is way less judgmental than saying artist and non-artist, right? In fact, the gentleman performing at the salon tonight, his music, he's like, please don't call me a singer-songwriter. He goes, he doesn't know exactly but the connotation, but he doesn't enjoy the connotation. So we met when I was talking to people about it. Don't call me a singer. I said, fine. But then I was like, wait, then what do I call him? I won't call him anything. I'll just call him a beautiful musician.
Perfect. Yeah. Yeah, so tell me a little more about tonight, because I'm going to record the music. So,
for the last several years, and this is all related to having gone through brain cancer and realizing that I had invited cancer into my life and taking credit for bringing it into my life and asking the universe, the source, oversoul, whatever you want to brand it, okay, your higher self, asking why I had invited cancer into my life. What was the lesson I needed to learn so that I wouldn't die, you know, so that I could heal? And now it's been almost 10 years since. And one of those aspects of life that I was shown that I needed to learn was self-love. And I've even written music about it. Perhaps some people even heard some of that music that I've written about, you know, learning how to love yourself. That is what, if you can learn that, then you will heal, basically. There are other aspects which are more personal, which I won't share. Although that one's pretty personal, too.
Yeah, it is.
But that's okay.
That's really foundational.
Right.
Learning to love yourself.
Right. So I spent years and years with healers and light workers and intuitives and metaphysical workers and people and human souls who have branded themselves with all kinds of different names, or labels, I guess is the word, right? Intuitive healers, metaphysical scientists, whatever they want to call themselves, spiritualists, new age, you know, all this. To me, it's all the same. It's all energy. And working to find my way to understanding better what the source is. What is the source energy? Like what, when I'm saying that I was told, who was I told by? Okay, my higher self. What is higher self? What is the source? What is this energy? What is oversoul? And sure enough, you could go on, you know, YouTube or whatever, and hear somebody talk to you about it and tell you what it is. But do you really, as a human being, understand yourself what that energy feels like? So I have been researching, and I'm talking about, by research, I'm talking about doing my own meditations and I get a lot of information through other people intuitively. And then I came out the other side, as I would say, somebody who's more vulnerable and who's more gentle. I was very, mean and angry and, resentful before I, brain cancer entered my life. And basically, the healers that I work with now and light workers, as they like to call themselves, are talking about becoming more and more gentle and more vulnerable. And this has now been popping up in my immediate life. And this music tonight is Chris Conti. And I had never met the guy. I'd never heard his music. I don't know anything. I do know something about him now. But he approached me to do this concert, which I couldn't do. So, but I said, hey, how about we try it out at one of my salons and see if it works? And he goes, what's a salon? What are you talking about, Andrew? So, and I still hadn't met him. Well, I'm telling you, we're just talking on email or something like that. I can't remember. Or maybe we're even on the phone. So this music tonight, it, in my opinion, the way he expresses himself through his guitar and his singing and his music is, there is a lot of healing and self-love there. It's very gentle music. And oddly enough, he was telling me, no, I want you to give me some of that, what you have, which is that high energy, you know, power, you know, in your face. But I was like, no, I want to come to you. I want the gentle, like, beauty, soft. And we rehearsed the other day, and his son was here. And we started playing, and Chris Conti stopped him. Wow, I didn't know you could play that, like, softly. I was like, yeah. So
there will be different dynamics, playing with different dynamics.
Yeah, and for me, it's a reflection of the gentleness and the softness that I've discovered in my own existence. And, you know, I think some people feel that maybe being soft or gentle or vulnerable are weaknesses, but it actually, for me, it's, and I know this is true for everybody, that these kind of emotions actually create strength and show strength in their own right. And whereas maybe before, you know, 10 years ago, before brain, I call it, you know, I thought anger was strength, because that's what I had learned from my father, and he probably had learned from his father, and so on and so forth. But actually, not necessarily the case. I'm not saying you can't get pissed off. If you need to get pissed off, go right ahead.
Yes.
That has its time and place. But so tonight, the salon with Chris Conti and Pete Rendy and this percussionist, who I've never met, I will meet him tonight on stage or on...
Here in this room.
Yeah, exactly. here in this room over there. I find his music to be very gentle and very soothing. Beautiful. So I have rarely been asked to make music like this in my entire life. I'm very pleased and almost like, you know, looking up at my higher self saying, see,
I can do it.
Now leave me alone.
right, definitely.
But
there's a whole range of expressions. So how wonderful to explore this when you're also in your meditation and research. It's very experiential. So this can probably tap into a lot of what you've been exploring in those silent, quiet moments. Or,
you know, it's interesting because what's been coming up, and this came up the other night when I was at a gathering, was that, you know, meditation, and I met this young artist, visual artist, and he's like, yeah, I was meditating in the woods. And I said, oh, yeah, I just did a 3-day, I was meditating 8 hours a day, you know, and doing, drinking juice and water only and the whole thing. And he goes, oh, where were you doing it? I said, at my house in Brooklyn. Anybody can meditate in the quiet woods at a meditation retreat. Now, there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
But the idea for me is to be able to meditate at all times, or whenever I need to meditate, whenever, and especially when I'm making music, is to go into that meditative state. And he agreed with me, this young artist. I mean, I actually don't recall his name, or I would say it, but he's like, yeah, right, we should be able to meditate anywhere. I said, yes. Yes, my son. Yes, this is the truth. Now, if you need to sit in the lotus position, or, you know, face the wall or face the room, or go to a special, you know, rug, or fine. I'm not saying anything negative about that. But for me, I think, and especially in this particular timeline, in this frequency, in this energy we are all in this moment, in this time on Earth, we need to be able to get to that place of connection and meditation and understanding what that connection means to our own higher selves, our own soul, immediately.
Yes.
And we all need to understand what that means. and not say, oh, wait, I got to run over to my house. I got to go in the corner. I got to get my car back. I got to sit in the lowest position. And then I'll meditate and see what I'm supposed to do. And then I'll come back and I'll let you know what, you know. So for me, that's really, I've lost my train of thought of what the beginning of the question was.
You didn't have to be off in the country somewhere on a mountaintop. You did that here. And, I was just saying that tonight you'll bring some of that vulnerability and that gentleness that you've been exploring. And I would say it sounds like you've been changing into, and it's not easy for people to change.
They say, and whoever they is, you can insert whoever you want, but I'm using the collective research that I've done. They, whether they are energetic or whether they are physical, doesn't matter to me. They say that getting a human to change is absolutely one of the most difficult things to do.
Yes.
So if for instance, yeah, I just told you that I invited cancer into my life and I understood that. But yet, there are many people who, if you said that to them, they'd be like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Exactly.
Cancer,
they would be offended.
This is not my fault. Mm-hmm. I didn't ask for cancer. And for the most part, humans seem to have the victim mentality. Like, this happened to me. Why did this happen to me? Instead of saying, why did I attract this experience? And I could even tie this into my salons, where what I do is I'm attracting an experience. And then I like to see how closely that experience I was intending to attract is to my actual original intention. And no judgments. I don't judge myself negatively or positive. I'm just curious.
Yeah.
So I don't really advertise. I do let people know, but I do it in a way that's sort of like send out a little telepathic message, you know, saying, hey, I think you, so-and-so, would enjoy this evening. And sometimes those people actually do come, and sometimes they don't.
Right.
They're like, I don't know why I'm here, but
right.
I heard you were having something and thought I'd join.
I think we're going to have a few of those tonight.
Right?
Yes.
I have that feeling as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially after, you know, having this, epiphany moment. I don't know how it is for you, Veronica, but when I go into when I have the chance to have these several days of meditation and cleansing, or, you know, I even hesitate to call it cleansing because people generally think of cleansing as you're juice fasting and you're, you know, whatever, you're taking these herbs. I was also cleansing energetically, a lot of forgiveness, a lot of clearing of my own energy and releasing some friends and family that I felt had done harm to me or been, you know, so it was
just
a cleansing, but
working
also
on many different levels.
It was also cleansing my heart and getting basically taking out my energetic trash, I guess would be an easy way of saying it. Mm-hmm. So having the opportunity to do that. So how often do people have 3 days to give to something like that? I think people can find the time, actually, to be honest with you, everybody, but I understand people have their excuses and reasons. You know, it's not like then on the fourth day, I was like, ta-da, right?
No, it takes
a minute for things to, on Earth, the energy is, it's very dense here. And that, I think a lot of us can know. Even when I say the Earth energy is dense, just feel how that feels when I say that. And you can, so in order for things to change is the word you use. I like to use the word shift, because shifting to me feels less arduous.
A little more organic.
Yeah, a little more
process oriented.
Yeah,
too.
So I always use we're shifting. So for things to shift, could it happen in the snap of a finger? Is there spontaneous healing? Yes.
Yes. Yes.
But in this case, I knew I had a good 2 weeks of time to let these 3 days. I didn't have to travel, and I was mostly.
You could let it percolate.
I could let it percolate. Didn't have a lot of obligations. And so tonight, I think, will be the unveiling of that. Will be the, you know, I mean, I think it's even happening as we're sitting here. I mean, even this day, I woke up going, ah, there we go. All right. Shifted.
Yes. Shifted. As soon as your eyes open, you could feel it. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, because I know you have the salon tonight and many other things going on. So thanks for taking the time to speak to me.
You're most welcome. Thank you, Veronica. It was great. Thank you. Yeah.
I recorded music live at one of Andrew's salons, a house concert. The music is composed by Chris Conti, who sings and plays guitar. Andrew is on alto sax, Pete Rendy on the Rhodes, and Yosuke Yamamoto on percussion. It's a pretty great band.
I was going to ask if I was...
This has been the Brooklyn Player Show. Keep listening to Radio Free Brooklyn.